Here's a list of girls that don't want to sleep with you.
What? I didn't even ask them. I'm in a relationship. Why?
They still don't want to sleep with you, Dave.
What?
Don't even think about it.
No, here's the reasons why.
That's right. Then they gave you reasons why.
Small penis. How did they know?
Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Sneaky Dragon Podcast. I'm Ian Boothby.
I'm David Dedrick.
And as you know, about every 4 or 5 months, we have another David on the show just to balance stuff out. We've had David M. from No Fun. We have had David Fine, the Academy Award-winning animator. And we're going to round things out right now with cartoonist, comic book artist, other ists that have to do with drawing. Mr. David Lasky is here.
Hi, Ian.
Hi, David. Hey, David.
Thanks for having me here.
Hi, David.
Is this confusing to you,
Dave? It is a little confusing. I'm going to change my name right now. I'm going to be called Richard for the rest of the show.
All right.
Richard Carpenter.
What? Is that the guy who killed his wife?
No.
Or was accused of killing his wife?
No.
And the one-armed man chased...
He is the brother of the Carpenters.
Is he?
Karen. Yeah. Karen and Richard. Yeah.
Oh, very good. Okay.
That's who I am for this. So if you have any questions about any of the songs we did, Close to You, I'm on the Top of the World... their fantastic cover of Hey, Mr. Postman, then, just ask me. I can tell you all about it.
Okay. Well, that's why we brought David Lasky here today, was to ask you questions about the Carpenters, the deep cuts.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. Don't go for the normal stuff. I can also talk about the song Eve, by them, which is...
I know that right now you're sort of promoting the Carter family comic you're doing. We're not talking about that.
Yeah, we're not going to talk about that.
That's just too obvious.
We're taking out some of the letters, or adding more letters, I should say, and making it into the Carpenter family.
Great. I've done so many Carter family interviews at this point. This is refreshing. Let's talk about the Carpenters.
Well, you know their song... now I can't think of it. Wait, We've Only Just Begun. Began as a advertisement for a bank. It was a jingle for a bank.
That's right.
Yeah. Written by Paul Williams. Yeah.
And then what they found out was, because they were trying to advertise to the young folks, then the bankers realized, we don't want that dirty hippie money, because they ain't got no money. And they went, screw it. But the song itself was very, very popular. So the song succeeded, but the bank ads were considered a huge failure.
Is that right?
Because it targeted to a market that had no money. that was the problem.
But that's not true. Because if you fast forward 10 years from there, or even 5 years, then you have all those dirty hippies becoming the even more dirty me generation. And they were filthy with lucre, and we were pumping up the banks. So
it was all because of that song.
All because of that song.
It planted the idea in their heads.
That's right.
Why am I doing this hippie stuff?
Yeah. What am I going to do with all this cocaine money? I should put this in the bank. I've only just begun.
Put all those $100 bills in there. That's right. Traces.
That's right. They're all kind of powdery $100 bills. What is with this money? It's covered in flour. That's what the bank thought. They're just squares,
Now, we were talking about when did the three of us first meet? Like, this is.
I remember, but I'll let David answer.
I don't remember, but I remember seeing Ian's comic books in Fallout in the early to mid 90s. And that was the first time I saw your work.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah, I think you knew of Ian before you met Ian, because we actually met when we drove Chester Brown down to do his signing at Fallout Records. And so you were just there. You were there to meet Chester Brown, and you're handing out one of your mini comics that you had spent, I assume, hours of tedious labor cutting out. You had a die cut in the cover, circle. And so you're telling us.
A long time ago.
Yes.
I had a lot more time on my hands.
You must have had a whole sore hands after that, because holding an X-Acto blade is no fun. So, I just remember that's.
Oh, that's a good memory. I guess if I hadn't handed out that comic, I would have just been some anonymous Chester Brown fan.
That's right, yeah. But you made yourself into a cartoonist by handing out a mini comic, which, that's what they should be for. See, my problem is I only made one.
You only published one issue of one comic?
I published one issue of one comic. And so people, it's like, yeah, Dave, we've seen it. We know you can stop hanging out now. We know you did a cartoon, we know you did a comic book 20 years ago. Good for you. Get out of here. So. That's what I got a lot of.
But you didn't do any cutouts or anything on it.
I did not do
that. That was your problem. No, that was your flaw.
Well, I added sparkle to every page. Sparkle glue.
Here was the weird thing about that Chester Brown thing.
Can I just say the only problem with it was you couldn't open the comic.
Some people say that was the best part.
Yes, that's true.
That's a mistake a lot of authors make, is letting people actually have access to their work.
I got a lot of that. Tom Spurgeon wrote back and said, you know what I like about this comic? You can't open it. I'm going to send it to Robert Boyd for his mini-comics column in the Comics Journal. And you're like, oh, great. I'm going to appear in the mini-comics portion of the Comics Journal. No, you won't, Dave. No.
I remember once I was hit-listed in the Comics Journal, mm-hmm. and it was the only time I'd ever been in any kind of publication and gotten no people interested in my work after that. No one wrote in, because it was here, if you send $2 and do that, and it would be in the back of any other comic, Cud or something, and it would be oh, you get 7 or 8 people would write in. It's that's nice. Comics Journal, bupkis. Just bupkis.
So maybe I'm lucky that nothing was done. Because I had that twice from 2 different people at the Comics Journal. They both told me they're going to send it to Eric Boyd or whatever his name was. And is that his name, Eric Boyd? Does anyone remember that guy?
Robert Boyd.
Robert Boyd, that's right. Sorry. Maybe I said it right the first time and mixed it up the second. I was conflating him with Eric Reynolds. Because I think that's who I gave the second issue to, was Eric Reynolds. Which was just and the hilarious part was, I think we were at some sort of a book festival here that was at by the Space Needle, and those cool buildings that were built there for the expo. And
oh yeah, I remember there was a giant 16? Arcade downstairs. There's a great ridiculously huge arcade.
Yeah,
it was fantastic.
So we're there, and so there was a Fantagraphics booth there, because I guess they figured, well, it's a book festival, we should show up here, and comics are books. And so so we were just talking with the guy there, just kind of chatting, and we actually took over the booth for him for a while. We went to the bathroom, and then we switched all the books around. No, and then. And then, you know, this is kind of same with you. This gave out the comic to him. You know, here, I do this. It's kind of funny. Here, read it. And then about 3 months later, I got a rejection letter from Fantagraphics. I didn't ask for this. This was not, what did I do? You know, it was enjoy the story. Good comic timing, but your drawings aren't good enough. What kind of?
And here's a list of girls that don't want to sleep with you.
What? I didn't even ask them. I'm in a relationship. Why?
They still don't want to sleep with you, Dave.
What?
Don't even think about it.
No, here's the reasons why.
That's right. Then they gave you reasons why. Small penis. How did they know?
It's in your comic.
It's in my comic. I shouldn't have put that in there. That's the one story I regret.
So that one with the cutout cover, was that wasn't the first mini comic that you did. How deep were you into minis by that point?
I had done a lot of the quarter size, meaning quarter of a piece of letter paper. I'd done maybe 10 of those, and then the cutout one was my first digest size, which was a big deal at the time. I'd seen Adrian Tomina is doing this digest size, and it's working for him. Maybe I'll expand to a larger canvas. And I actually was my decision to do a series called Boom Boom. I had been doing those little quarter size minis, calling most of them Boom Boom. And I thought, let's make it a series. Even though I don't have a character or a continuing story, I was starting to think about marketing. And, and I applied for a Zarek grant and got it. And
oh, okay.
So that cut out. Boom Boom number one was printing was paid for by the Zarek Foundation.
Oh, okay. So how many did you print of it? Do you remember?
Printed about 1,000. So over time, I cut out, I think, 1,000 of those.
You
covers.
Must have regretted that at some point. Around 501, you were probably.
I'll just say I haven't done a die cut since then. I'm good with die cut.
Yeah, I remember that fall, that was where I picked up Adrian's book for the first time. I think it was about 4 issues of Optic Nerd.
Yeah.
And that was the real game upper for me when I saw that. I was like, oh, because I knew a lot of people who did minis, but they were kind of a little slapdash. And, it's just tell your little story. But I was like, well, oh, this guy's trying hard. Now we all got to try a little harder. Thanks, you jerk.
You know what the funniest thing is? I thought he was my age or in his early 20s, and he was in high school making those.
Those mutants.
I couldn't believe it when I heard that news.
Well, I don't want to name names or spill any beans, but he was actually held back 4 years during high school. Sorry, Adrian.
But if you look at his work, let's just talk about Adrian for it. Let's make the podcast about Adrian. If you look at like his earliest issues up until like issue 4, like the leap in, I don't even quality because it's still good stories, but like he just tightened up things so much that was just all right, here we go. I find that like now I do stand up and you see some, like someone will come in and all of a sudden really put in a lot of effort and you're like, okay, I can't just do my, you know, dibbity-bobbity-boo, you know.
What is it about video games?
Yeah, pretty much. Pretty much. So how many Boom Booms were there in total? And did it then become Boom? Was there a, then? Am I remembering that right or was that wrong? When it was a full-size comic, was it still called Boom Boom?
Yeah, it was still
I might have just read it once, then the title and just blanked on the second one. I apologize.
Well, I was really shy about putting a comic out, so sometimes I would place things on top of the second Boom, maybe. So maybe I just let people see one Boom on the cover. And they can open it up and realize that there's another Boom. So I did four digest-sized self-published comics and then got the contract with Aeon to do four commercially printed, distributed to comic stores comics. And the main reason I wanted to go with the publisher was because distribution was so hard for minis. And I had like 1,000, I was printing 500 or 1,000 of each issue. And they were just in boxes. And like, I know there's people out there who would buy these, but it's such a hassle to find the stores. And this was before internet, of course. So, you know, how do I find the stores and how do I find the time to get things out to where they need to go? It was like a whole other full-time job.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, I had a full-time office job and full-time comics drawing job, and I didn't need a full-time distribution job on top of those two jobs.
We needed a Johnny Appleseed of comics you could just give your stuff to, and they could travel amongst the land.
There were a few like comic, like Puppy Toss and stuff like that, that acted as distributors. Or
that's true.
Still in
Spit and a Half. And
yeah, like
Wow Cool. Yeah.
Because the people like Dylan Williams and stuff like that that are out there, you know, kind of promoting, pushing other people's work as well. It's the, but yeah, it was, you know, yeah, it was hard, wasn't it? Like I was terrible at it because I have the worst. I just don't believe people when they say, oh, that's good.
I'm you would walk into a store and go, you don't want this, do you? And they'd go, nope. And off they have to go, that's what I thought.
That was basically my sales technique. It was kind of like that, yeah. I got this kind of piece of junk here. I don't know if you guys want to put it in this thing or not. I don't know. I don't even know how I get paid. And I'll just leave it here and I probably won't come back again. So, yeah, it was just like,
I'm so sorry. Set the store on fire. Leave.
Pee on the door as I left. I don't know why they don't want me back again. But yeah, it was like when I went down to...
But they remember you. And that's the thing with marketing. They remember you.
We went to the first ape, and I think you were at the first ape too, right?
Yeah.
Alternative Press Expo.
Alternative Press in San Jose. And yeah, there was a guy there that actually was really interested. He wanted like 20 copies of Rounders, which I didn't have because I'd sold quite a few. And I never sent it to him.
Yeah, your method was, this was basically, hey, are you a cartoonist? And you're, who wants to know? It's like, I don't know. It seems you set up a table here. Yes. I'd like to buy some lemonade at your lemonade stand. Why?
Fuck you.
Yeah. I guess people don't like lemonade.
See, this is a problem. I have a terrible time admitting what I really want in life.
I'd like to buy a comic. You're openly weeping at the table, trying to fix all the issues.
It is terrible.
This is a bad time. Come back another time.
That's right. Having some issues, but not just with the comic.
There's a publisher that's like that now. What is their name? They're the art comics publisher that Dan Nadel does.
Oh, Comic Box or Picture Box?
Picture Box, yeah. I saw them at SPX a few years ago, and like they had this great table of all these beautiful books, but there were like three guys, and they were all standing like 10 feet back from the table. And I was trying to get their attention, but they were busy in conversation.
They had their phones out.
Excuse me, I'd like to buy one of your books. And they didn't hear me because it's a loud room and I have a soft voice. And I waited for about 10 minutes and realized, no, they don't really want to sell me anything. I'll just order online.
You didn't meet their criteria. I guess. I don't know what it was.
They could tell I didn't really have much money on me. He's not going to buy the Gary Panter book. Let him go somewhere else.
It's like whenever you see a TV show, a sitcom that's set up in a store, no one ever comes in to buy anything ever. Yeah, yeah. You're just like, how does this store exist? You just have wacky antics. And it's like, you were just walking in the middle of the sitcom. It's like, yeah. Who's this jerk?
Does he actually want to buy something from us?
I know. I'm trying to tell this guy I got a date with two beautiful ladies tonight, and I don't know what to do at the same time. Yeah. Why don't you disguise yourself as two different guys?
Yeah, I don't know which technique works better, like walking around the con. You know, there's lots of people there who are up-and-comers or who are selling their stuff. They have three or four issues out and things. Some of them are very aggressive, and they approach you as you come up, and that's sort of nerve-wracking. Because I don't, it's not that I don't want to buy it, but I'm not, you know, I want to look at it. I want to kind of see what it is.
Yeah.
And then there's other people who are kind of ignoring or just drawing. They're just doing sketches while they're sitting there. And that does, it seems to me that neither are very good. The guy who's ignoring you because he's sketching, it doesn't draw you to the table. The person who's in your face and trying to sell it, it doesn't help either. Unless you are going there to buy it, in which case you just sort of...
Well, the drawing guy, you feel weird interrupting.
Yeah.
Because obviously they're in the middle of something. You don't want to bug them during work.
Yeah.
So it's like, all right, yeah, leave that guy alone.
Yeah, I guess there's a middle ground where you are half drawing and half looking at people as you walk by, doing terrible stick men drawings.
My angle was two things. One, I would try to be having a conversation. Like if I was sitting with you, I'd be talking to you.
Yeah.
And someone would come by and I'd go, just take a look if you want anything. No problem. And just make it clear that, you know, look at stuff.
Yeah.
But my best thing was going to as many panels as I could to talk, because that's people coming who are interested in stuff.
Yeah.
And then you can actually describe your thing there, and then they go afterwards and I kind of get it.
Well, what Ian's best thing was, is he's ignoring, is the fact that he produced 16 issues of a, or 18 issues of a comic. But even when you went to 8 the first time, you had 6 or 7 issues.
Yeah, but that's not necessarily the best thing.
No, that is the best thing, because
it's not.
You have a body of work that's sitting on the table.
No, it sucks. Here's why.
Well, if you've only produced one comic in your life, then you would be envious of a table full of issues.
Exactly.
But say you had 4 issues of your mini. That to me is sensible, because someone picks up the first one, goes, oh, I like it. And they could pick up all 4, feel like they're getting it all. Mm-hmm. But if you see 18, just ugh, you know, which one should I? It's first of all, which one should I get? Well, don't get the first one. I was shit then. You know, clearly I'm better now, but I won't get it. It's not, it's somewhat related. Some stories can, fuck it, just leave. You know, I pull a real Dave there. And again, I just pee on all my comics so no one can touch them.
And set them on fire.
Yeah. There's problems for all. I'll just direct them over to David Lasky's table. He's really good.
He's only got 4 issues.
Do you like Ulysses? It's great. He covers it. It's really, really good.
So, yeah, that's a good question. Why were you so into Ulysses? Are you still a giant Ulysses fan? Or had you just read it at the time and it really kind of...
Well, yeah. I just finished college and it had been assigned in an English class. Mm-hmm. The whole novel... We were supposed to read it in a month, and I could barely get through 10 pages in a month. And there were, you know, students who really got it and were into all of the intellectual stuff, and mm-hmm. I felt like such a lame brain.
They're picking up all the mythology, that's all the allusions to Greek mythology and everything.
Yeah. That, by the way, would be a great title for a comic, Lame Brain. Throwing that out there. Any young cartoonists going, what could I make my comic? Anyway, but please continue.
And, so to get through the class, I read some books about Ulysses, kind of skimmed.
Mm-hmm.
So I knew enough that I could tell the professor a few things about it.
Fake it till you make it.
Then I went back afterwards and actually tried to read the book and found parts of it are really great and parts of it you just can't understand. And during the whole ordeal of Ulysses at the time, I was thinking, why is there no comic book version? Because then I would get it immediately.
Yeah.
So I set out to make a comic book version with as little pain for me or the reader to kind of understand the overall story and characters of Ulysses.
Mm-hmm.
It's a tiny, for the listeners who don't know, it's a little 4x5 mini comic in 12 pages, encapsulates Ulysses, the 700 page modern novel. And you don't really, from reading my comic, you don't really understand Ulysses that well, but you kind of can say, I know who the characters are and what they do. And that's kind of, it's helpful to a lot of people, I think. It's been my best-selling book ever.
Wow.
As far as I know, I haven't received the numbers for the Carter family yet. But,
yeah.
I've sold thousands of the Ulysses mini comic, and it was very early in my career as a cartoonist, and I took it as a sign, because no one was that interested in my other mini comics. But like, oh, I did something that people liked. I'll continue with making comic books, and I do like Ulysses. It's actually a huge influence on me once I did read it and understand it better.
Mm-hmm.
I continued with some James Joyce themed comics over the years, but I'm kind of at a certain point, people started introducing me as the James Joyce cartoonist.
Yeah, yeah.
Or once James Sturm said, the James Joyce of comics. Is it okay that I say that, David? And like, I guess. And afterwards, I was like, no, that's not okay.
Yes. You're clearly the Sylvia Plath of comics.
That's right. Yes. I did read Ulysses. I tried to read Finnegan's Wake, but it is not something that you can.
Yeah, I'm still trying to approach that.
Yeah, it's actually much better to read things about Finnegan's Wake, like other books that mm-hmm. describe and tell you what it's about, because it is so ridiculous that.
Could I ask you a favor? It's mm-hmm. like, when you finish reading it, could you make a comic of it for me?
Okay.
Just so I would understand it.
Do you remember, this is, Ian and I once went to a movie called Finnegan's Chin. Do you remember that? There's like a there's a theater in Vancouver called Pacific Cinematheque, and it's just as pretentious as the name is. And they're doing like a cartoon festival, but before it was a documentary about Monty Python.
Python. That's what we're going for.
Yeah.
For the Python. We missed the Python. We were too late.
No. It was canceled.
Canceled.
So they replaced it with this art film called Finnegan's Chin, which was about a guy getting up, shaving, having breakfast, and getting his bike and leaving the house. It took an hour and a half. The movie kept repeating scenes over and over again. So he would get up, he would do something, and then it would go back. And then it had this weird kabuki theater moment where he's dancing with some sort of dragon thing. And
then he's back to shaving again. Watch him shave, like, honestly, 100 times.
I was like 18 years old. I'm like, what the bleep is going on? Like, what? But, you know, and the guy actually did warn me when I bought the ticket. He's like, you know, like, Monty Python was canceled, and, you know, we're playing this movie, and it's not for everyone. I'm like, oh, okay, I'll go see it.
I like,
you know,
that most movies has some nudity, coarse language. This one just said, fucking dull.
You will not know what you're watching. If you're 18, this will make no sense to you. Even if you're 22 and been to film class, you may not enjoy this. Like, it is just, I don't know, it's just weird.
Was it connected to Finnegan's Wake in some way? Was it a tribute?
I guess so, because the book itself is about a very small event, as I understand it. And it's been a while since I attempted it, so it's a bit blurry in my mind. But it's a very small sequence of events that are stretched out over a huge book, and it tells a story in different languages. And it's just like within a sentence, it uses four or five different languages. Sometimes it's very confusing and hard to read, I think. And I think he intended to make it that way. It's like he was going insane from syphilis and then wrote a book. That's what it reads. I mean, that's what it feels like. It just feels like he just went insane and wrote this book. And then people can't admit to themselves that this man lost his marbles near the end of his life after this monumental book, Ulysses, which was this huge work that influenced so many people at the time. And I mean, even today, there's Bloomsday in Dublin in Ireland. You can go there and trace the steps of I think it's in Dublin, right?
Yeah, it's
and then you can trace the steps of
Leopold
of,
Bloom.
Yeah, his day, the story of Ulysses through the day. And because Ulysses is just a story in one day, too, and it's a huge book, right? So mm-hmm. I think, so he took that idea, and then he just squished the amount of time the story was telling, and then but expanded the amount of verbiage to tell the story. And so this movie kind of follows that idea of having a very minor thing with sort of dreamlike elements in it, and then expanding that over. And so the you know, like 5 minutes of someone breaking an egg into a pan, you know, crack, tsh, crack, tsh, crack, tsh. Like, okay, boy. And then, oh, he's getting his bike out. Finally, something else. He's leaving the house. Yay. What? He's back in bed? What? Why?
What it felt like to me is just in filmmaking, how you do a shot and go, let's do another one for safety. Let's do another one. Let's get some coverage on that from another angle.
Yeah.
And they just used all the footage. Just went, let's not edit it. Run it like that.
Yeah.
Straight out. Go to town. Yeah, that was a long, long hour and a half.
That was a nightmare.
It really was. Let's take it to the present day.
Yeah.
We're here now.
By the way, we were kind of talking about our childhood.
Oh, that's right.
People should have taken a drink.
Right. That's there's two drinking games we have on our show. One is every time we talk about our childhood, people take a drink. Two, if a siren goes by, we take a drink. There are no sirens today because we're in Seattle. And
there's no crime, no fires ever happening.
No, it's really beautiful here. Yeah.
I haven't seen any. We haven't seen any police incidences at all. Incidences? Is that a word?
Anyway. I did a show at the Theater Sports down here at the Market, and I come out at midnight, and I've never seen four blocks crime scene taped off before. Four solid blocks. It's like, okay, that was a big crime.
It was a shooting.
Yeah.
Two young...
Over by the Market, that's the area where our crimes happen.
Oh, you just keep it all there?
Yeah. You guys are in the crime-free part of downtown right now.
And how they stop crime is a guy throws a giant fish at the criminal.
Toss. What happened was there's two young men who, very intelligent, decided to get in an argument and then shoot at each other. A ricochet happened, and it hit a woman in the arm near the Market. It went quite a distance. So I guess that's lucky that it was probably slowed down a little bit by its distance and hitting something and ricocheting and hit her in the arm. So she was, you know, besides being shot in the arm, she was okay. But
is this recently?
This is Friday night.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I think I heard something about that.
I think, it's one of those incidents where it's like, so it's not important enough to like lead the news or be on the front page of the paper. So you just it kind of percolates down to us.
But I had to walk four blocks out of my way. So I think the real victim here is me.
It's obviously you.
Yeah, it's clearly me.
I no longer feel that sorry for the woman. It's all about you, Ian.
But we're in the present day when I had to go for an extra long walk. And you're now promoting a new book. Boom, boom, to hell with it, you've said.
You've out of print and you
disavowed.
Know, yeah, it's my early stuff. I don't like it anymore.
Source of shame, a monkey on your back. If you find a copy, burn it. That's what we're saying.
That's what David wants you to do.
Right. So
even if you're in the store, just light it on fire there.
So we're in a different world right now.
We're talking a lot about burning comics today.
Yeah, we are. We are.
That's because we're in America, the land of book burning.
You know why? I think it's because the room's a little cold. And I'm like, ah, it's cold a nice roar. A little bit.
But I think because you're close to the vent. Sorry.
It's possible. I'm not complaining.
Okay.
I'm not complaining. My legs are sore from that walking. So that's why.
But
we're no longer in a world where you cannot communicate, where you have to actually talk to people. You can do stuff via the internet. And so your latest project, you have used the internet to get it out there. Explain yourself.
Well, I didn't use the internet to make a web comic because I'm not that web savvy. Like some people draw a comic and then scan it with their phone and color it in their phone. And then like 10 minutes later, they're getting comments on it. And I don't own that kind of phone yet.
I hear you.
All the scanning and coloring and posting takes like a week for one page for me because I'm using 1980s technology. Actually, late 90s, really. I should be honest.
Yeah, be honest. Yeah.
I've got a Mac Tower from circa 1997 and it still works great. So why get a phone that can do everything 10 times faster?
And you draw with the pencil and a dip pen.
Do you use a dip pen?
I do.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
I really like those.
I find them hard. So that's why I said that.
They are hard. It took me a few years to really get really comfortable and not have drops of ink dropping on my art all the time.
My problem is because I use a brush. And the nice thing about a brush is pretty much when you put the line down, it dries. So you can like put your hand on it. Like a minute later, you can just put your hand over it and continue inking in that area. But with a nib, you put down your line. It takes like 5 minutes for the stupid thing to dry. Mm-hmm. So I'm not used to that. So I'm like, I got my hand in it, and pretty soon like that drawing is like stamped throughout the. Very frustrating.
The manual Xerox machine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I still do that from time to time, but I make a mental note to start in the. So I'm right-handed, so I start in the top left corner and ink things. And then the things that I haven't inked, I just set the page aside and I go eat potato chips for 20 minutes and then come back and do more inking.
Well, you know what? I'm starting to like the sound of this inking. Because brush, you just do it because you don't want to stop because then your brush gets hard. And
I think you're just liking the potato chips aspect.
That's what I'm liking.
Just throw the snacks in there. Yeah.
That's awesome.
Have an ice cream cone, come back.
Yeah, it's a great idea.
But back to the internet.
Sure.
It's this great invention. Whereas I was saying in the 90s, I would run ads in the Comics Journal, which apparently nobody was paying attention to. And trying to get, lists of stores in other cities and send them postcards or call them on the phone. And it was just a huge hassle. And with the internet, all that stuff, you can get it in seconds, stores, and you can email them, and it's amazing. But it also creates more work for everybody, because now I used to write letters on paper, and you would write somebody and send it, and 4 days later you might get something back if they live near you, and you can consider what you're going to say to them next. But now it all happens a year's worth of correspondence you do in an afternoon with somebody. Anyway, I'm not complaining. I love the internet. So I started work on The Carter Family, my first big graphic novel, in collaboration with Frank Young. And we weren't using it as a web comic. We were just making the whole book, and then people get the book, and our editor at Abrams, Charlie Kutchman, said, "This is a really strange thing that you guys don't have a webcomic, and nobody's going to know what you're doing until the book actually comes out." And we kind of realized this was a little bit of a disadvantage for us. So Frank started up a blog, and we posted little bits of art and things on the blog, but not a lot of people were looking at the blog. But people kind of, their word went around the comic, what do you call it? The
community?
But the online comics community.
Yes.
People I didn't even know knew that I was working on this book.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, cut to, we're 3 years into the book project, and we got to get it done soon because the publisher really wants it. And we've run out of money, and we're working part-time jobs and drawing the book. And I keep hearing about this thing, Kickstarter.
Right. Because you got to pay for your time and potato chips. Every panel is a full bag of chips. That's going to cost you.
Yeah. The snack food I consider kind of an art supply.
Yeah.
That's part of my art.
Write that off. Absolutely. That's tax deductible.
That's a real IRS head scratcher there. Okay.
You like the fancy chips, not that generic concept.
Yeah. So we tried Kickstarter, and it was wildly successful. I couldn't believe how successful it was.
Well, it was a really good video that you produced.
It was actually Frank's friend, James Gill, helped us.
Okay.
He knew all the video stuff, and I just provided him with JPEGs and photographs, and he montaged them really nicely. And he did it pro bono, which was awesome of him. But some people donated, and I asked them, did you like that video? And they're like, I didn't even watch the video. I just want to see you do a book day. Or I just want to read a Carter Family comic.
Yeah.
If I had done this book in the 1990s, I think first nobody would have published it, probably, because graphic novels were not booming like they are now. And there would be no internet, so people who would potentially really like this idea of early country music and comics, probably 10% of those people might hear about it, and the others would never know it existed, I'm guessing.
Yeah.
The internet it changes everything.
And if you're,
is old news for a lot of people.
No. And the 1990s, if your book had come out, it would be in bookstores next to Calvin and Hobbes. It would just be, it would actually be, because that's the C section of the thing. They were all just all jammed together. You'd get, Mouse and then Snoopy right next to it. And it's just it's all drawings. There you are. Mm-hmm. But now, Abrams is a great publisher as well, and they really know how to market things. So that's fantastic. Yeah. Yeah,
they did a beautiful job just producing the book itself. I was surprised when I got the first copy. I didn't know it was going to look this nice.
How exactly did the collaboration work between you and Frank? Did you both draw on it, or did you both Like, was
That's a good question, because somebody pointed out yesterday how we don't really say who did what, and it's complicated. We started out both co-plotting the book in outline form.
Yeah. Although, to be fair, there was already a life that you were, you know, so... No, I understand. Okay, go on.
We co-plotted it.
Wait, you're not pulling a Seth thing here. These people exist, right?
Yeah.
Okay, because I'm not getting fooled again. All right.
That's right. So it isn't a hard life if you don't weaken? Is that what you're telling me? I've been following the wrong advice all this time?
Well, we'll talk Seth. After.
Go on. Okay.
We drew...
I'm just going to pocket my outrage.
We drew thumbnails collaboratively. Like, I would take a chapter and thumbnail it, and he'd take the next chapter and thumbnail it. Because he can draw fairly well. He produced about as many comics pages as you did.
Yes.
Just a few years earlier.
I admire him. Great.
And then he switched to being just a writer. But I got him drawing again. And when it came time to expand the thumbnails into rough draft pages, I just did all of those myself, and he began scripting. And to kind of even out or distribute the labor evenly and be able to divide our checks 50-50, I said, Frank, you know Photoshop. Why don't you do the colors?
Okay.
And he had never colored a comic book before, but he did know Photoshop, and he works on PowerPoint presentations for clients sometimes. So he, once he finished the script and I was producing the inked pages, he started coloring. And some of his earlier colors, like we had had a talk about, we want a color palette that's like old comic strips, like Gasoline Alley from the 30s. And that would really put the reader in that time and place of the Carters in the Great Depression. So he had a color palette, but every now and then he would sneak really bright colors into it.
Fluorescent pink.
And I was like, what? That's not a 1930s color. We can't use that. And he's like, well, okay. And he finally got to where he was sticking to the color palette he started with. And he told me, it's because I work for these clients who have PowerPoint shows for Microsoft, and they want the colors as bright as possible, because people in these meetings, they watch PowerPoint all day, and they need bright colors to keep them awake. So that was his natural inclination, just bright pinks, bright blues, bright orange. And he had to really shift gears for Carter Family, and he did an amazing job.
I thought the coloring was really good. It's a coloring style that appeals to me. I just like that kind of flat, you know, not heavily affected.
Photoshop-y.
Yeah, with all the kind of
gradients.
Yeah, and spray paint effects and stuff like that. It doesn't really do it for me. I like that Tintin, you know, palette. That's what I love the most. So
I think that flat color palette works best for comics.
I do too. I think
it's distracting when things get too modeled.
Yeah.
When you look, you walk into a comic shop now and you look at the wall of covers that's there every month in all the new comics. It's just the most unappealing mess for me to look at. Nothing is appealing in there. You know, and what stands out for me when I'm looking at it are those flat colors. You know, some old fashioned nut who still just uses, you know, just set colors as flat. When I was looking, I bought a book of how to color in Photoshop just because I was curious. You know, I do it quite often for the Sneaky Dragon title cards and things. That's where I colored in Photoshop. But I was just curious what I'm missing, because I've just self-taught basically. And so I was looking at it, but I'm only interested up to a certain point. As I was looking through the book, I realized, because once he gets past this, you know, what to him is the beginning of it, just getting the flat colors down on the paper, I'm like, I'm done. You've got it perfect right there. Like, stop. You've got like a very limited palette and no need to go on. It's just perfect where it is.
Yeah, because some people want to be photorealistic, but we have access to photography.
Yes.
That's covered.
That's right.
So just do this. It's fine.
That's right. Because comics is design, right? Because comics is closer in a way to graphic design than it is to art, if you know what I mean. Like when you look at a comics page, you're judging it as almost as a, you know, as a design more than as artwork. You know, like it's one thing to look at a picture, a pretty picture, yeah, like a photorealistic painting of a tree or the painting I love so much, Millais' Ophelia. This is like a perfect painting, right? Like, but when you get close to it, you can see that it's painted. But when you're standing back from it, it's so photorealistic, it's crazy. But it's, you know, it works as a painting, but that's not what you want in a comic, because you don't want that kind of detail. You just want, you know, you want that design element, that kind of graphic. You know, you understand what I'm saying, right? Mm-hmm. I don't sound insane. Mm-hmm. Ian's looking at me like I'm a crazy person.
No, that's how I normally look at you. Don't worry. It's just a standard look. Okay. No, I have found that, though, in comics. Yeah, you're right. They go with the photorealism, which doesn't seem to be necessary. I mean, it's a choice. If you want to do it like that, do it like that. And covers, to me, when you're talking about walking to the store, they've just become generic. They're just...
dark and generic.
Yeah. They're filling time until you get into the collections, because the trades are how they are the final home, and that's what they're looking to be. And yeah, they're not as fun. They're not as fun anymore. That sounds like old man talk, though.
We are old men, by the way. So, yeah.
And I want to say flat colors work best, but there are exceptions where... the watercolored comic sometimes works well. I'm not quite finished, but I'm reading The Now of Brown. Have you guys seen that?
Yeah.
And that's, I believe, watercolor and pencil with a font for lettering. And it works really well. I got really drawn into that book. And I think, you know, if you don't overdo the modeling or the shading, it can work nicely.
But of course, watercolor is a sort of natural medium, so you don't have all the shiny gadgets and stuff. And I mean, the problem with Photoshop is it allows for people who don't have the who can't filter, you know, that urge to to over ice the cake. I mean, it just lets you over ice the cake. You can have all the flare effects, all the shininess, all the glinting and shading and everything you want that you don't need. You can just keep adding and adding and adding until you just have this, you know, 2,500 layer image for Photoshop, you know.
I think maybe watercolor works in comics because it's organic and depends a lot on
it's a soft pellet.
It's a paper-based paint.
And you look at Tintin. I mean, Tintin, like when you look at the paint, like if you look in your book, you can see like that it's been hand-colored. You can see where the brush is a bit darker in some parts of the image and things where, you know, so you can see that it was hand-colored and just in a very soft, you know, painterly style. And that's, you know, because I sound kind of Tintin crazy, but it's like this, you know, the pinnacle of comics for me. So in terms of art and everything, you know, I just love it. So yeah. You want to say something?
Yeah, I was just like, well, why isn't David Lasky the pinnacle for you? David, how does he fit in that pinnacle?
He comes right in, he's like one, then he's 1-2, David Lasky.
Okay,
he's
good. Like,
Tintin and then me.
That's right. Just, and nothing else. Stops there. I don't want to, you know, your book is beautiful. The Carter family book is absolutely beautiful. So you did a super great job on it. When you started drawing it, did you like start at the beginning and then work to the end?
Yeah, we did it in chronological order, mainly because I wanted the art style to change slightly over time.
It will, won't it? Yeah, yeah.
For a long project, it's going to change anyway, unless you're a very disciplined artist. And I wanted the way it, a lot of our philosophy, I don't know if philosophy is the right word, our working method was to evoke old comic strips as a way of evoking the times and places that the story is happening in. And so I was looking at, like, it starts in the 1890s, so I was looking at The Yellow Kid, and the very first page of the actual narrative, it's like right behind the title page, I think, is just ripping off The Yellow Kid to tell a knowledgeable comics reader, hey, we're in the 1890s, you might recognize this look. And then from there, try to move toward a 1920s and toward a Gasoline Alley kind of look, but without actually aping that style. Originally, our plan was to just ape different styles, like every couple chapters, the style would jump to something else. And our editor said, are you sure you really want to do that? And I thought about it and was like, no, that's like 10 times more work on top of all the work I'm doing. Yes. So I kept my own style, but flavored it with other artists' styles.
So that's why part of the book, they have no eyeballs, just blank eyes.
That seems to be a big part of like a lot of different art forms is, getting rid of the clever. Just so, and your initial idea is like, hey, it'd be fun and clever and whatever. And then they go, let's just tell the story or sing the song or just get to it. But there's quite often, especially in film, I know people who are like, we're going to do it. This is an homage to this. And there's going to be nothing but Dutch angles. And then it's just like, nah, just tell the damn story.
Yeah.
Get it through.
Yeah. No, that's true. The same thing with color, right? It's just simplicity is the most appealing part of what, because what we like about simplicity is we feel like we could do it. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So when you're watching it, the feeling like you can do it, but the cleverness of it is very appealing. Mm-hmm. Very complicated, noisy things kind of separate us from the film. That's why like the newer Star Wars films don't work very well, because they're so complicated and noisy and fake feeling that you aren't drawn into them. Whereas the original Star Wars, it feels like I could be part of this. Does that make sense? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, so you want also like if you did do, say, it looked exactly like Yellow Kid, then it looked exactly like Gasoline Alley, then people would, you'd at least have that. So even if the story wasn't strong, people would acknowledge that and just like, I get it. I'm clever because I get this. So, and you get the nods and there you are. But it's a safety. And then it's better just to take the safeties off and just do the thing you're going to do.
Yeah, we realized, we're working with a great story. It's a true story. And let's serve the story as best we can.
Mm-hmm. Were you a big Carter fan of the Carter family when you started it? Was that the impetus to it?
Yeah, I had heard their music in the 90s on CDs that Rounder Records was putting out.
Okay.
And they would have a few little liner notes, but there was not a lot of information about who they were. And there were no, at that time, there were no actual biographies that I could find.
Mm.
And there were some short memoirs with some anecdotes. But it was 2002 when I asked Frank, who I had known for years, and I knew he knew a lot about American music.
Mm-hmm.
What do you know about the Carter family? And he knew a lot. He knew a lot of the anecdotes. And we pretty quickly decided we would make a comic, a short comic, which we did. It was a 10-page story that appeared in Kramer's Ergo or Ergot, however they pronounce that.
I think it's Kramer's Ergot.
Perfect.
Thank you. That's German, so I think.
And then as we were working on that story, a full biography of them came out called Will You Miss Me When I'm Gone? Which was a great book.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of collected all the existing anecdotes and interviews and then brought in new information that the author had uncovered. And Frank and I thought, wow, there's enough material. We could do a full graphic novel biography of them. But who would publish it? And who would pay for a full color book of comics about a country music group? So it was in 2002, 2003. Mm-hmm. And I talked to Jeff Mason at Alternative Comics. I talked to Dylan Williams at Sparkplug. And over the years, succeeding years, we talked to different small press comics publishers. And, it's full color. Maybe you do just a 40-page teaser to start and see if it sells. And they were kind of like, yeah, it's a great idea, but you should find someone bigger for this. And because of the color is expensive to print, and I had no clue as to how to contact a bigger publisher until things really started booming around 2006, and it was early 2007. I visited New York just for fun to visit friends who all happened to be cartoonists, and they were all talking about their agents and deals, and so-and-so got all this money, and so-and-so is on the cover of the New Yorker now. And I'm like, what just happened?
You took a nap, you wake up,
exactly.
Different world.
Because I was just in Seattle delivering bread for a living, and you guys are talking like you're,
writers from like the 1950s or something.
Exactly.
What are you guys, John Updike and John Cheever sitting around?
It was a Rip Van Winkle kind of moment.
That's right. What's that Adrian Tamani doing now? I'll just pick up this copy of the New Yorker. What the hell? How did he?
The mini comics kid. It's just, I remember when he was six and publishing.
So what was the question? Did I like the Carter family? Yes, I did.
No, I was just curious because, I I've only heard them like in a couple, like the Harry Smith anthology and things like that, where I have to say they really stand out, like just their, because, you know, you're listening to a bunch of kind of people who are rough around the edges, and then this one group that kind of, it's kind of like when you're in the mall and the Beatles start to play, and like the whole kind of level of professionalism and musicality kind of goes whoop up through the ceiling, and you're like, this is great.
I was going to say the professionalism in the mall. Everyone starts getting their shit together Julius stand, like, all right.
They're just kind of bland, sort of
change the hot dogs,
regular
everybody.
Music playing, and even though you've heard all the Beatles songs like a jillion times, still when it comes on, you're like, I want to hold your hand or whatever, you're just like, hey, this is a good song. I forgot how good this song was, you know, and the same with the Carter Family. When it comes up amongst, you know, all these kind of pretty good songs from the 1930s, a lot of, you know, kind of roots music or whatever you want to call it, you know, this blues or whatever that was recorded at the time, they really like kind of stand out above them because they had this really interesting sound, like a really amazing group dynamic that really worked well together that, you know, they probably constantly tried to destroy, but, you know.
You should put one of their songs at the end of this, Dave.
Because they're a band. Yes, I will. That's a good idea. Thank you for putting that.
But you were saying you were looking for publishers, and then when did Abrams come into the picture?
I found an agent first.
And he said, you're going to be rich.
He did. How did you know? That's exactly what he said.
Ian's an agent.
I got home from New York and I contacted all my New York friends and said, hey, tell me who's a good agent. And none of them wrote me back.
Good friends.
That's right. Get out of here, bread guy.
I think I just wasn't persistent enough. Yeah. Like, you have to write New Yorkers 3 or 4 times.
Oh, okay. And then they'll pay attention.
Then they know you really do want an answer.
Well, they were all working on their Time magazine covers because it was the boom.
They're very busy. But
Working with Banksy on a full...
I got a Saturday Evening Post thing to do. I can't be talking to you guys.
It was ironically Ellen Lindner in London recommended her New York agent to me. And this is like, you know, could only happen on the internet. It wouldn't have happened in the 20th century. So I contact the agent and send him Carter Family samples. And he's very excited. And he tells me, you're going to be rich. but not in those words. But he's very excited.
Did you say 1920s family singers, buddy? That's exactly what we're looking for. Did you say flat color? All right, pal. Back up the money truck. How'd this 50 get in here? Get that out of here.
Burn those with the rest of Boom Boom.
It was mid 2007 at that point, and people had just gotten incredible advances, like ridiculous. Like, publishers would never do that now because they know better.
they know they're dealing with artists. Wait a second, these guys don't actually produce anything when they have money.
But we were. True. Do you remember Tundra? That all worked out fine.
The publishing world was still on the tail end of this incredible optimism. What's the term? Exuberant something.
If this was a montage, everyone would be drawing while Walking on Sunshine was playing.
Exactly. So he was very excited, and there was a general trend that I was detecting for historical kind of educational, biographical, graphic novels. For some reason, that's what publishers were looking for. So I was like, I've got that. I can do that.
Because of Mouse? What would it be? Is that their kind of, their touchstone? Is it like Mouse? Does it have like a historical element to it?
Yeah. What was the thing that was really cooking that they were like, we want to ride this history wave?
Because, it was kind of weird because that Genesis thing that Crumb did, you know, like, I mean, obviously it's not like history, but, you know, it's like we need this sort of thing that people will connect to.
Well, I know the runaway success of that time that they were looking at was Blankets, I think. And that was a true memoir kind of story. But I don't know why they wanted biographies.
Yeah.
But that's everyone was talking about their agents and saying, yeah, I'm going to do a biography or I'm going to do this historical thing. Mm-hmm. And it's like,
oh, it's because of Louis Riel.
Louis Riel did all right.
Louis Riel did pretty good. So that might have been it. I'm just trying to think of what.
You can be in two sections of the bookstore. And also, you know what? I bet it'd be easier to publicize a biography, you know, if you're, you know, it's like, who's it about? It's about this. Okay, go on. Here's your fresh air interview.
It works so well in America. It's about Louis Riel.
What?
You know, in the Red River Settlement, Red River Valley? Do you mean that song that's from Texas? No, it's actually from Manitoba, the Red River Valley.
No, we changed it to Texas for this, for the American edition. Yeah. Subtle changes. Does he have to die at the end?
I was surprised that years after it came out, the Seattle Public Library still did not have a copy of Louis Riel. And I put in a request and I had to write why they should buy it. And I said, you know, this is one of the best graphic novels ever made and you don't have it. You have a lot of other graphic novels that are not the best. You should have this one. And they got it immediately,
which was great. That's good.
But I think the Canadian thing was a barrier for some Americans.
It's an interesting story. I mean, I guess it's not, maybe it's not a cross-boundary story. You'd think it would be, but maybe
I can see how it's not an easy sell. I can see how.
Because it has a French-Canadian element to it. It's, it's obviously it's a story about Canada and everything, but.
Is your book in the library now?
Yes.
Nice. Good job. Is this the first book you've ever had in the library?
Yeah, the first full book, like I've been in anthologies. And that's exciting.
Now that I'm thinking about it, that might be the real reason they want educational and historical and blah, 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 because they want library sales.
And schools
as well. I mean, if you can get like Persepolis, my daughter's reading for university, in her university course.
I bet Persepolis had a lot to do with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, that's probably a good point. And so, yeah, I mean, if you're on reading lists for universities, I mean, that's an amazing thing. That's good fortune. Obviously, it's not something you can plan. You can't like write, I'm gonna write a book and I'm gonna have it sold in universities. You can't say that. I mean, you could say that, but you're probably not gonna be successful. It's just lucky chance.
I just want to say that the professors listening, if you teach music history, music appreciation, American history, Americana, and comics, and American culture,
you should really look
cultural
at
studies. Mm-hmm. Look at Persepolis.
Yeah.
I can't say enough good things about Mouse, everybody.
And the Carter family.
What we're saying is...
Oh, and the Carter family also is very...
What we want to say, like Michael Caine, get Carter.
The Futurama Simpsons crossover book I did was published by Abrams, so I've done some signings at Abrams. And I really like the books they've got. It's like a really wide selection of...
And they do amazing packages of... Like the packaging fantastic. for your book, which, by the way, I still have, so you can have it back with them.
Okay.
But I don't know if I should say this, but did Abrams ever give you a copy of your book?
Okay, well, here's the thing that's weird about that. No. All right, yes and no. No to a copy of my book. Yes to a copy of anything else. So that's strange. Like, I had a guy come up to me. Maybe I shouldn't be saying it. I'm going to say it. So I'm doing a signing, and he says, listen, this book's been selling quite well. If you want a copy of anything else we've got, not a copy of my thing, but a copy of anything else. Actually, you know what? I can get a copy of mine for a discount. I know I can do that. But, like, anything else. So I was like, how much are you talking about? Like, how many books could I have? Whatever you want, buddy. I'm like, all right. So I went through a checklist, and I got a whole bunch of them. Then they sent them to me. It was great. But it's because they were on Cloud 9 from the Wimpy Kid books, which just sell.
Yeah.
It's like the second that they print one, it's sold. It's just, it's Roadrunner Dust Cloud. It's just like sells so insanely well that, they're fine. The Wimpy Kid books pay for everything else.
My nephew has read them all.
Yeah. My niece and nephew love the books as well completely. Mm-hmm. But that's where the big money comes from at Abrams. Yeah. That's their Spider-Man. And I'm glad to see that they are, you know, doing stuff like your book. That's fantastic.
Yeah,
we have the same publisher. Hooray!
Wow.
For a disclaimer, we should say that I'm being interviewed by someone who's also published by Abrams.
Right. So I could be on the take or on the something. You know what? If you need some of your books, I can get them. And I would appreciate it if you got some of mine and we do a swapsy. So I don't know how this all works.
Yeah.
But I had heard.
And Ian's has a die cut cover. You may not want to see it, actually, now that I think about it. You may never want to look at the Futurama collection.
That is
Simpsons
true.
Crossover.
But what did you hear?
I had heard from James that months and months ago that you guys had done this book that was successful and never got a copy from Abrams.
And that's James. He will find the one dark cloud on a beautiful sunny day.
But, you know, it's your own work. in a book. They, you know, they sent me a box of my book. They got like 20 copies or more.
Well, I remember like James
wondering, should I start a campaign or an online petition? Like, get these guys a copy of their book.
Yeah, we'll just do it for each other. Why not? Like, I remember there was a, because, it's James and I did a Simpsons Futurama crossover for those people who are listening.
James Lloyd.
And it was funny because it got nominated for, I think, a Harvey and an Eisner. And James, I just had to convince James that he had been nominated for an Eisner. He didn't believe it. It was like, well, it's not. It's just a reprint of your work. You drew every drawing in that book is his. There's like these large sections that are like his pencils, and there's notes that he made and everything like this. And he just could not accept that, like, nah, it's not me. He just, like, once he's done something, he's distanced from it. But yeah, so have a talk with that guy because he respects you.
Oh, well.
All right,
he's great. He's
fantastic.
An unknown gem.
Yeah.
In the world of comics.
Yeah, he's working on. I guess I shouldn't say what he's working on, but he's working on something that's biographical as well. Which, by the way, is how you get rich. I found out.
Yeah, I just heard that too.
Yeah.
Now you tell me.
Right.
So I shouldn't do a single comic about some guys in the '60s living on the cheap in a rural area. Are you telling me?
Well, that was a fantastic pitch.
That's why I sold so many of them.
You remember what your book was about.
That's why I sold so many of them. People loved it.
I'm going to get you in touch with my agent, I think. He'd be very excited about this.
That's right. I can make you a bit of money. That's what he would tell me. And I'm not even going to take a cut of it because there's going to be none to take a cut from, what I'm telling you.
So what
did you do a second issue of Rounders?
I drew out like a complete thumbnail of it, but I had a few roadblocks. I had cancer.
Oh, wow.
Then I had post-cancer. Then I had kids. Then I had full-time.
That'll do it.
I had full-time job, full-time kids, not a lot of time. So I had a few problems.
You did do a short story, though, with the characters. You did a couple of little short things with the characters afterwards.
Maybe that's what I'm thinking of.
I think they're all everything I drew is in the book.
Is it?
Are you thinking of the phone story?
There's the phone story.
It's in Rounders. It's in the comic. Yeah. It's at the end of it.
All right. Very good. For some reason, I always think your mushroom manure story is them, but that's actually a true story.
That was a true story. Ian and I have done a few jam comics together called We're So Jar that one of us wrote the story and the other one drew it mostly in there. So I could do those sort of little things, but I couldn't do like this full scale. I'm going to sit down and draw 24 pages of, it's hard enough just to get me to sit down and draw, let alone draw 24 pages of something. So, but I do have it sitting in a binder still, actually, two stories, mostly planned out. So all stick figures and, just so I could, cause that's how I script. I don't write it out. I just draw it and then I'll cut out panels and retape them onto the page to, if I change my mind and I have to like move things along, I'll just cut them out and reconfigure it all onto pieces of lined paper. It's incredibly,
You can use Photoshop for that now. It's fantastic.
This is what I used to do when I was working. So I would just draw it while I was working and then just fix it as I went.
My wife keeps saying that she's going to teach me Photoshop and it never ends up happening. I'll eventually have to.
I'll teach you Photoshop.
Yeah, everyone says this and it never ends up happening.
Next time I see you, I'm going to teach you Photoshop.
All right.
Because you don't need to know very much to do what you want to do. That's the way I can teach you.
Yeah, it scares me. Computers scare me.
But not that.
I like seeing with your pen and your whatnot. It's just like, David Lasky still uses a pen and thing. It's still fine.
It's something we were talking about yesterday because Pia was going to a digital inking panel. But I would miss inking. I was saying to you, to me that's like, and I compared it to penciling is like making your bed. You know, you make your bed, and inking is like sliding into your bed into a freshly made bed. You know what I mean? I just love to ink all that hard work. Is that the inking to me is like, that's a relaxing time. That's like the fun time of getting the brush and doing the thick thin and trying to get that Warren Kramer inking line, you know, like the Richie Rich I just love that clean style of inking. And I just always try to get it that way when I'm drawing. And, I would miss that. Like just trying to do it on a Cintiq. I can't do it anyway because the nib is about a quarter of an inch away from the paper, it feels like, because of the screen thickness. So it doesn't, there's something unnatural about it that I just can't. Maybe if I did a lot, you could get over that, but I just.
Yeah, I've tried it on a really early version of Wacom and just drawing on something while you're looking at something else and the feel of plastic against plastic and. people have told me, well, they changed all that. So you can draw on the screen and you can put a nib on so there's some give and a little springiness. And well, maybe I'll try it. But, you know, I've got ink and paper and it doesn't cost much. Why would I want to buy it? Expensive tablet.
Mm-hmm. And I could write using Word, but I like this Gutenberg printing press I've got over here. I like taking the letters and moving the type around.
You never did that, though. Before you had a computer, you either typed or
I used a typewriter once upon a time. I do not miss that at all.
No,
that
I don't miss
it. Nightmare. Every step of the way, it's just been like, yes, better, much better, much, much better. Fantastic.
Well, I guess so, but I still, when I'm writing, I still print out when I'm writing. And then retype it all back in again. I don't correct on the screen. Like, I don't edit on the screen.
You're a madman.
I have to retype it all back in.
No, you don't.
I do.
Oh.
I do.
Okay.
I do.
We all need to just get to the future.
Because it's funny, like, I'm sure all of us have different ways of writing. Like, Ian, I know you like to go for a walk. If you're having a problem with a story or whatever, you go for a walk.
I go for a walk regardless. Yeah, that's how I write. I can't write sitting at a desk and just like think of ideas. Like that's the nightmare to me. Like I've had writing jobs for television where we all have to sit in a room and just like write in the room. It's just like, just let me go for a damn walk. And I can't come up with nothing until I take a bathroom break. Then I'm in the bathroom and like just that walk was enough. Come back, write down all the ideas, scribble them down. Yeah. I got to move to think.
For me, I have to be writing in order to be thinking of the story. Like I can have like moments of inspiration while I'm driving or whatever, where I'm like, oh, that'd be a perfect drawing or that's a good idea to write about. But when I'm trying to like problem solve through it, I have to be working on it. If I'm just like at the gym working on the treadmill, my mind is nowhere near what I'm working on. Like it's just daydreaming about whatever, riding a horse in the Olympics. I don't know what it's joking, but you know what I mean? Like whatever.
Tell us your dream.
Did you just picture all of a sudden a thought balloon just above Dave's head and just him on a horse kidding. And Mitt Romney going, no, better, better.
I always bug.
You're losing the election for me, you stupid horse.
I always bug Lisa, my wife, for that's her daydream. But when she's doing something where she doesn't want to be there, you know, and she's just like staring off and like, oh, you're just dreaming about riding a horse in the Olympics, aren't you? So, yes, I am.
And that takes us back to Rounders. They had horses there, didn't they?
That's right. Yeah. But at the time, my wife, because I'd never really experienced the rural life. I grew up in a suburb. Mm. And when I met my wife, her family had like a 40-acre farm in South Langley near the border, near the American border. And so it was a whole new world to me, like, you know, going to this place in a little farmhouse with a big old-fashioned farm with a hip roof and a hayloft upstairs, which is absolutely illegal to build because of insurance issues. You know, just no one has haylofts.
Why? What's the problem?
Because hay will self-ignite. Like it'll spontaneously self-combust and burn a barn down.
Oh, it's a self-starter situation.
Because it gets super hot in the hay bale if it's wet. Mm. So you have to make sure it's dry when you're so... Like when we used to have the hay, we would shove our hand into the hay bales to feel how wet it was. Because if it's damp in there, it's terrible. So when you're stacking the hay, you put salt on it as you're working because the salt will pull the moisture out. And you create vents as you're building as well. So the hay has air flowing through it.
Well, now here's the thing. Like I'm just curious about this. So you got hay is grass, right? Like
yes,
dry
it is.
Grass?
Yes.
Okay. So,
but it's incredibly compacted.
Oh, that's the problem.
That's
so
right.
Like dry grass just on its own, if it's a real dry summer.
It's not dry grass, though. It's if it's wet. So
okay, but I'm saying if it's dry grass originally,
it's fine.
It falls over. Now we have a rain. Now it's wet. And then tick, tick, tick.
Yeah, no.
This is going to go up.
The wind can blow through it and everything, right? So it'll keep it dry. So the problem would be like if you were haying and say you're haying in the lower mainland or, you know, in the Fraser Valley kind of area where it's rainy, like here in Seattle, then you're going to have the possibility that you're going to have like a bit of wet before your hay comes down. So you cut your hay, then you do what's called tedding it, which is this machine that has spinning things and it flips all the hay around and creates these kind of leaves it in layers. Loose layers on the ground so that it can kind of get dry. And then you put them in what are called windrows. So you turn your tedder and you kind of flip it around. And so then it's tedding towards itself. And so it creates these windrows. It creates rows of the hay in the field. And then that also allows it to dry. And so while you're doing this, you're praying that it will not rain. Because if it rains at any of this point, you've just lost all your hay. It's worthless. And I've had to move worthless hay off a field, and it's a lot of work. And that was just like a couple of circuits had been cut. And it took us like 6 hours to get it all off the field and down in the back into the burning pile. So you don't want the rain. So once you get it there, once you have the windrows, then then that's when the baler comes out. So then you bale it. And the baler, it collects these windrows, it collects these lines of hay, and it compacts them into these really tight bales. And spits those out onto the field. Then you go around in your wagon, and you, this is a small operation. Obviously, bigger places have like the automatic things that collect the bales onto it and stack them on the wagon and everything. But we were just kind of like a small farm. We took off about 3,000 bales in a year. So it was, and so we just put them on the wagon, took them down to the barn, and then just moved them using a hay elevator, this spinning conveyor.
They call it a hay elevator?
Hay elevator, yeah.
Hay elevator, not hay, a hay elevator.
No, hay elevator.
I would have called it a hay elevator.
Yeah, you would have.
They should call it
that's yeah. A, like that's that. A patented name. We can't use it.
Okay.
It's copyright, trademark.
Edit that out of there.
Yeah, right. Sorry, I don't want to get sued. And we're in the States, the land of the lawsuit. So yeah, it goes up to the hayloft, and then you stack it up there, and you have to stack it a certain way. And some years it would stack so high that I could actually touch the barn roof, and it was really high up there. So and it was a lot of work because, we weren't like a full scale operation. So you'd handle the hay like 5 or 6 times getting it up to the top, because you'd throw it up, then you climb up again, and you'd throw it up again, and believe me, by that point the hay is really heavy. There's nothing heavier than a hay bale at the end of the day. So,
like, I would actually read a comic book about this hay. Well, like, the way you've just described it. Who the hell would think, like, hey, you know what's interesting? Hay. Like, just that alone. Well, like, and, like, the danger of the one little bit and the rain.
Well, that's
and the
actually
fire.
The third issue of Rounders. They do hay in it.
Awesome.
So, if I did draw it, you would have all that information.
When your last child has gone off to college, get out the Rounders notes and sketches.
I will. Yeah. I do plan to. So.
Good. Yeah, okay. Because I was going to try to get Mr. Lasky to shame you into doing it.
I was one of the biggest Rounders fans.
Oh, well, thanks very much.
Every time I'd go up for a Vancouver Comic Con, ask around, where's the Rounders guy? Did he do a new issue? Like,
Nope.
I sit at home. He's around, but he hasn't drawn it yet.
Yeah. It's just, I do feel kind of ashamed about it, but
no,
you know, circumstances, just being what they were, I couldn't.
Don't be ashamed of cancer.
I'm not ashamed of cancer.
Don't be ashamed of your children.
What do you mean? I'm not ashamed of my children.
Oh, it sounds like you are. Sounds like you're blaming them right now.
I just feel kind of ashamed that I let those things stop me from drawing.
Okay. Well, here's the thing. Your hands are not broken. They can draw now.
Yes.
You draw every week for this show. Yes, clearly you can still draw.
Yes.
This can all still happen.
Yes.
All right. Look at, be inspired by this young man over here.
Yeah.
He did a graphic novel. It's in libraries, for crying out loud.
He has
loud.
An agent who's going to make him wealthy.
Right.
This is
wait, no, he's
story.
Already wealthy.
Oh, sorry.
He's rich.
He's rich. He has a lot of bread.
Yeah.
Do you still do that job, or do you?
Every now and then I work as a fill-in delivery driver for the bakery.
Okay.
And yeah, I'm just to make it clear for listeners, I'm not rich, and don't contact me with proposals for this invention you have.
Okay, I'm going to put away this patent thing I had here.
I'm just struggling month to month. I'm not. We got an advance for the book, which was a pretty good advance.
Yeah.
And it's probably going to take a while to recoup that, if ever, for the publisher. I don't know how it's doing. What was the question?
That wasn't the question. You were just making a statement.
The question was, what's your favorite type of bread?
So I'm teaching.
He didn't answer that. He doesn't like bread anymore.
My favorite bread is hominy from the Tallgrass Bakery in Seattle.
Oh.
You know, free commercial for Tallgrass. That's the bakery I work for.
My favorite bread is sourdough.
That's so boring. But that's okay.
That's me.
I love that one thing about that was judgmental and all this was just like your love of sourdough.
The interview was going fine until he said sourdough. No, sourdough is actually a great bread.
That's right.
It's a good all-purpose
bread.
With
the Carpenters with some knowledge. I didn't even get a put down on that one.
Yeah, we've said some controversial stuff so far, but this whole thing matching.
My first day at the bakery delivering like 6-7 years ago, they said, take any loaf you want home with you. And I took like basic French bread, and they're like, you're taking that? There's all these other great breads, and you're taking the flour and water boring bread? Like, okay. Like, well, I'm going to try the rest later.
I love that it's like a record shop. It's just like, I'll take the Beatles. The Beatles? Look at this guy. Johnny French. And they called you Frenchie for the rest of your Never lived it down. Well, I think we're on the wrap-up right now.
Yes, we better
start. So clearly, if we could say one thing to you, buy this book. You could get it from your library for free. Don't do that. Don't do that.
Because you're going to want to have it for the rest of your life.
Well, here's the thing. You buy it from a
beautiful thing in your library.
It's a beautiful thing. And just on a hygiene thing, books from the library get taken to the shitter. Like, everyone reads it on the toilet. So you know you're enjoying this book, and you got to wash your hands an extra 3 times afterwards because someone, you know, let's be honest, that's what library books are. They're for the bathroom. Libraries are a cesspool.
Go to the library, and then like a day later, you've got a bad cold.
Yeah.
Do you ever make that connection?
Yeah. You ever see when they take the books from the people, they never like scrub them down, give them a little misting. It's like right back on the shelf, buddy. You know, so forget that. Your Carter fan. It's just called the Carter Family.
Don't forget this song.
Don't forget this song.
By Frank M. Young and David Lasky.
Yeah. And you can get that in your local bookstores. Abrams has it. If you are the author, you can't get a free copy.
That's not true. Unless you're Ian.
I can't. Oh, yeah. I can get yours. You can get mine. Or order it. Like, go on the online. We were talking about the wonders of the online. Go to Amazon right now and order it. Do it.
Yeah. Go to Amazon.ca. Oh, wait a second. .com.
Or the online retailer of your choice.
Exactly. Yeah. All right. Normally we plug things that we're doing, but you know, we're in America. We're not going to do that. America is not about promoting yourself.
Yeah, it's not about self-promotion here.
No, it's not. It's
like
about
the
art.
Sedate country in the world.
That's about flat colors and love.
And selflessness. Selflessness. Americans use that word on a daily basis. That was good, but was it selfless?
That's right. I've noticed that about the sports here. It's all about giving.
That's
right. It's just about the giving people.
And so the two things to remember, buy the book, and if your hay gets damp, for the love of God, get rid of it, because it's going to self-ignite.
It's going to get moldy.
That's right. So keep your hay dry.
I know.
Reading your books.
I know more about
hay. Do not go to the library. God bless America. This has been Sneaky Dragon. I've been Ian.
I've been David.
It's another David over here.
Oh, sorry. I've been Richard.
Thank you, guys. This has been a lot of fun.
Great.
Thanks for coming.
Thank you.
Bye, everyone.
Hello, stranger. Put your loving hand in mine.
Hello, stranger.
Put your loving hand in mine.
You are a stranger,
and you're a pal of mine. Get up, rounder, let a working man lay down.
Get up, rounder,
let a working man lay down.
You are a rounder,
but you're all out and down. Time. I ride 6th and 4th streetcars.
Oh, every time.
I ride 6th and 4th streetcars.
I can see my baby
peeping through the bar. She bowed her head. She waved both hands at me.
She bowed her head.
She waved both hands at me.
I'm prison bound.
I'm longing to be free. Troubles are like mine.
Oh, I'll see you
when your troubles are like mine.
Oh, I'll see you
when you haven't got a dime. Weeping like a willow, mourning like a dove.
Weeping like a willow,
mourning like a dove.
There's a girl up the country
that I really love. Put your loving hand in mine.
Hello, stranger.
Put your loving hand in mine.
You are a stranger,
and you're a pal of mine.
Terrible.